Down south, they say it's the economy, stupid. Up here, we say it's the economy, eh? And this is Political Economy Radio, a progressive take on economic issues in Canada and beyond. My name is Michał Rozwodski, and welcome to the show. Today, my guests and I will be looking at the future of public education and resource development on First Nation lands, two issues where British Columbia is on the front lines of bigger social conflicts. My first guest is Halesia Luke. Halesia is on the board of the BC Society for Public Education and has extensively researched topics in public education. In the midst of BC's continuing teacher strike, she wrote a very incisive article on how the government's $40 per day cash payment to parents fits with broader efforts at education reform. Here is my conversation with Halesia Luke. So Halesia, you recently wrote a piece about the government's policy of giving parents these $40 per day per child during the strike, and linked this to an education reform called vouchers. Maybe you could first briefly explain what a voucher school system is.
Mm-hmm. So in a voucher system, the government basically issues an amount of money directly to parents, and parents in the form of a voucher, and parents take that voucher and they shop around for a school that they would like to send their child to, and then the government applies that amount of money to the school that the parents have chosen. Sometimes the voucher is worth the whole price of the admission, and sometimes it's worth a portion of it, and then the parents would have to pay an additional fee on top of it.
Right. So this is touted as sort of promoting, school choice and choice for parents, which, you know, sounds good, or at least innocuous for many people.
Yeah.
But people like yourself have argued that in reality, this system is likely to be harmful for children, for the education system. Maybe you could explain a bit.
Yeah. So you're absolutely right. The voucher system is one of several different systems in what we call the school choice basket, and school choice is a really codified term that means something quite specific. As you say, it sounds nice, but what it really means is the money follows the head of the child, and it turns schools into a business model that has to compete. They have to compete against each other based on, you know, a number of kind of specious. Governments usually promote standardized testing as a way to compare schools, which we know is really inaccurate, and they have to basically fight for the dollars. So what ends up happening typically in any school choice system that has that kind of mobility is people, first off, it's human nature. People tend to be attracted to other people who are like them, whether that's neighborhood or a class, their own class, or maybe their interest. Maybe they're interested in the arts, or maybe they have a special interest in science. And that's the way we act as human beings anyway. And then on top of that, you also have bias. So you have people who may be consciously or unconsciously biased about other people. Maybe it's new immigrants or people with different languages or a part of town that they view as being, you know, undesirable, or perhaps within a community that's maybe in a different class than they are. So it in all instances, in all of the reports that have been done, particularly on the United States, they found that these school choice systems, voucher or charter, tend to group kids more and more. They basically segregate them by class, ethnicity, and ability. I think this is sort of exactly the opposite direction that Canada wants to go. I wouldn't argue that the Canadian system is a perfect one, but we're heading in the right direction, and I think what we need to do is enhance and improve the direction we're going in terms of equity, inclusion, and not just take a left turn or a sharp turn here and go in a direction that actually really doesn't serve our long-term interests.
Yeah, and what I think is interesting in what you wrote was that there's actually links between the government in BC, the ruling BC Liberals, and promoters of vouchers, and that they seem to be, you know, some of them would definitely want to take this term. Maybe you could expand a bit on some of these actual links that exist.
Yeah, so some people have as long memories as I do. So my, you know, part of the context for me is my oldest child entered school in the late 80s. So I've watched, you know, three decades go by here. And when the Campbell government was first elected, very quickly it became apparent that he and Christy Clark, who was the education minister at the time, had a real infatuation with the U.S. system, which was a head-scratcher to a lot of us, because of all the systems in the world, that's sort of the last one anyone would want to emulate. Yes, there are tremendous successes in individual schools in the States, but it is a patchwork of successes and colossal failures. So as a system, it's not something that one would want to emulate. But pretty quickly, they started bringing in experts from the States, and typically they were charter school principals and educators who came from a really different context than BC. They came from very large, typically inner city schools where funding had been cut and cut and cut in the States over the years, to the point where their only option was, or they felt their only option was, to become business-like models. So principals emulated CEOs, and their job was to go fundraise. And fundraising from large corporations seemed to be the way to go. Or, alternatively, setting the school up as a charity, which is also something I personally find really offensive. The idea that public education is a charity is definitely not part of the Canadian, modern Canadian view of public education. And so they marched in all of these experts, and we all sat through all that, wondering what was going on. And then they started to make a series of legislative changes that would make it much easier for this kind of a system to happen here in BC. And one of them was they got rid of school catchment areas. So now, under the guise of parent choice, if the school has room, you can send your child to any school regardless of its distance from your home, which was a way to undermine neighborhood schools. And another thing they did is they really started eviscerating the role of school boards, which are democratically elected governance bodies. So they started eroding their decision-making ability, their ability to adequately fund through budgeting. That's been really well documented. And then they brought in another thing that was really peculiar. They brought in the school planning council. So typically schools have always had parent involvement, but it has never been entrenched in legislation. School planning councils are in the legislation, and their composition is described. And it is a parent-dominated group of five, I believe. Teachers are not allowed to serve on it. And in their capacity as being a parent at the school, there's a teacher representative on it. And many of us viewed that as a very big move in the direction of creating school-based governance that could directly talk to Victoria and bypass the boards altogether. And one of the tasks that they gave these new school planning councils was to develop and approve school plans, which is basically a strategic plan for the school about improvement and budgeting, actually.
Right. And I think not all of this was sort of done, I think, also in the context that you've mentioned and others of general underfunding for education. And it seems like all of these things sort of work together as well, no?
Absolutely. So at the same time, they reduced the funding. They like to say they increased it, but really what they did is they rolled in a lot of fixed costs into per pupil funding. That way they've been able to say that they've increased that, but really, if you go back, the overall envelope of funding for schools has decreased. And then I think that became pretty clear that what they wanted to have happen was they wanted the schools to duke it out. They wanted the school community to say, okay, we're short of money now. Are we going to cut our librarian time, or are we going to cut our counselor time? What are we going to cut? And they wanted very much, I think, for that decision making to happen at a school-based level, which again undermines the idea of equity. It undermines the idea that every school is equipped to deal with adequately with what children need.
And maybe in the last minute, you could say a few words about how this cashes out sort of going forward. I know teachers have opposed vouchers, especially in the United States, but here as well. And in particular, why is this current strike an important battle in this sort of conflict over school choice and this kind of experimentation in BC?
Right. Well, typically what we see is governments taking the opportunity of crisis to introduce these kinds of systems. Happened in New Orleans after Katrina. Now you see pretty well a full-out charter school model now for the entire state. It was the opportunity of the crisis to introduce change, and I think that's what is happening here. the offer of $40 to parents per day is unprecedented. It's ridiculous. According to the finance ministry, you can spend it however you want. There are no receipts. So in this case, they've introduced a charter that's not even, you don't even have to spend at a school or an educational institution. It's, I definitely think this is a trial balloon that the government is floating to see if there's any appetite for this within the public. Perhaps they're hoping that there will be pop-up schools. Perhaps they're hoping that people will get together and say, hey, you know what, just give us the $40 a day and we'll educate this little group of, you know, 100 kids. And if that starts to happen, then that will very much erode the system as it is, and it will give the government an excuse to sort of go into the end game of school reform and do what I think they intended to do to begin with, which was to really remake BC's school system.
We'll end it there. Thanks so much, Alicia.
Yeah, no problem.
That was Alicia Luke talking about the BC teacher strike as part of a broader battle over education reform. My second guest is Chief Joe Alphonse. He is the tribal chair of the Tsilhqot'in National Government. His government recently declined to sign an economic cooperation and revenue sharing agreement with the BC government that would have covered proceeds from the Gibraltar mine. I spoke with him about this decision. So the Tsilhqot'in National Government, of which you're the tribal chair, recently rejected an economic cooperation development agreement, or ECDA, with the BC government, and that would have had you sharing revenues from the Gibraltar mine. Maybe you could start with a bit of background and tell me what an ECDA is and what the Gibraltar mine is.
It's an impact, it's an economic benefit sharing agreement, usually for communities that have mines in their traditional territory. And the agreement that we turned down was actually for the Astila community or Alexandria community, which is located between Williams Lake and Quesnel, BC. And they've been negotiating for the last 5 years trying to get impact benefit agreement and to no success. So Alexandria actually requested the assistance of the other Tsilhqot'in communities. So as tribal chair, I got involved and helped assist the community in trying to resolve the impasse with government and with the company. The company is owned by Just Equal, which also has another interest out at Fish Lake, which was rejected twice by the Canadian Environmental Review process. So there's long history with the company.
And Why specifically, what were the reasons behind the national government deciding against this particular agreement?
Well, I think we if there are going to be agreements like that with government, we felt at that time that, you know, it has to be meaningful and it has to provide a sufficient amount of resources to the community. Community of the law, I think they've been very patient, very understanding. They've been, you know, trying to deal with this issue in a respectful manner. But, you know, they signed a law for, you know, there was just not enough resources provided to the community. And, you know, there's too much open-ended for interpretation. I think, you know, in light of the Mount Polly situation, we felt that the amount of resources they were talking about was not adequate by any means. And just 1 week before the Mount Polly disaster, we had one of the local communities, Shuswap community, our neighbors, had received a check for $4,500 for revenue sharing agreement from, and they were anticipating $400,000. So that's quite a drop, and so we didn't want to be in that situation. And there has to be room for negotiation. There was the province left no room to negotiate.
And did the spill at Mount Poly itself, did that impact your decision making as well, sort of seeing that devastation right next door?
I think it's had a bit of impact. I think we had arrived at the decision before the impact, before the disaster happened, and that just strengthened our position, I guess.
And I saw that you also, the national government released a whole mining policy not too long before this. How does this decision fit more broadly into your policy around mining and around resource use in your territories?
I think there's always been great concern from our nation about mining, especially in light of what happened with the Taseko mine at Fish Lake and the spin that they would put on things or whatever. And their interpretation, the reality we saw were two different things. And we wanted to, we went through the Canadian environmental process, which is not a cheap process to go through to protect our interests. And we just want to make sure that, we're being responsible and we're providing ourselves with, policies. And in the event that companies like Taseko want to take advantage of our nation, then, we're going to have things to fall back onto.
What are the possible conflicts between mining and the other activities that, what are the other uses of the land in your territories, and how does mining impact those?
Well, from our perspective, you have to have clean water. You have clean water, you have a healthy ecosystem. And the fear with mining that occurs near large bodies of water is the contamination of whole waterways, which affect just about everything. Vegetation, we rely on medicine plants, we rely on wild game. You have moose deer that might be drinking and feeding off of those plants and water, and that can be affected in a negative way. And lastly, I think we have the largest sockeye run on the Fraser River, which is near and dear to the heart of all Tsilhqot'in people. And that's our first priority, is to protect our salmon stock.
I only have a couple minutes left, but maybe I can ask you a couple broader questions. How this fits in, do you see this decision and ones like this reflecting a changing relationship between First Nations and government and industry?
Well, development can happen. We're not dead set against mining, but if you're going to engage in that type of venture, then you have to rely on all of the professional opinions that are out there and take everything into consideration and not just look at it from an economic place. We have to look at the ecosystem. We look after Mother Earth, and Mother Earth will look after us. And that's how we look at the world. And in terms of relationship, I think government has to recognize First Nations interests in certain areas, and even to the point that they recognize First Nations as a new level of government that they have to work with.
Given that, how would you like to see? How would you and how do you feel like the nations that make up the national government, how would you like to see the process of economic development proceed in your territories?
Well, instead of those types of agreements, maybe the companies coming in, maybe they work with us a little more closely. Don't come in when you got a finished product and expect us just to buy into it. Maybe you need to have some of our members on the boards of these companies and allow us to help the companies develop the whole mining plan. If you want our support, that's the way to go, and include us in every aspect of the development of that mine. And finally, partnerships. You've got to have partnerships. That if you're a partner on a company, then there's no need to have these type of economic benefit agreements or anything like that.
So directly, sort of being co-owners or having some sort of interest in the company itself, so that you're receiving part of the profits or what have you that comes from these.
Yes, absolutely.
I'm going to have to wrap it up there. Thank you so much for your time, Chief Joe Alphonse.
Okay, thanks.
That was Chief Joe Alphonse of the Tsilhqot'in National Government talking about his government's decision over revenue sharing with the province. That's it for this week. Tune in 2 weeks.